Mr. I think it's Mr. Vuletic. Could be Dr. Vuletic.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioners. Mr. Vuletic is another Aucklander, so hopefully we've got him ready on Zoom. And I hope you have his written, we've sent through his summary statement this morning, so you should have that available as well. So over to you, Shane.
Morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Yes, I've submitted a statement which I will read through. It should take comfortably less than 10 minutes.
Thank you.
My name is Shane Vuletic and I'm the Council's Section 42A expert on economics. KiwiRail's perspective on the economic impacts of the project has been provided by experts Richard Paling and Fraser Colgrave. Broadly speaking, Mr. Colgrave has estimated the economic impacts associated with the construction of the freight hub, while Mr. Paling has estimated the economic benefits associated with the ongoing operations of the freight hub. Overall, I agree that with these experts that the freight hub is likely to give rise to positive economic benefits for the region. I also broadly agree with the categories of economic benefits they have outlined. There are some aspects of Mr. Paling's and Mr. Colgrave's work that I believe are likely to result in KiwiRail's quantified benefit estimates being higher or lower than their true value. While these impact the magnitude of expected benefits, they do not change my overall view that the project is likely to be economically positive for the region. There are, however, several aspects of the project that I believe could significantly influence the level of economic benefits and costs that flow from it. These include the ability of the freight hub to integrate with the wider regional freight system, the impact of the freight hub on local traffic conditions, and the level of certainty that will be provided to residents and businesses affected by the project to allow them to make long-term planning decisions. In my view, KiwiRail's approach to these issues will have a significant influence on the extent to which this project is viewed as a success by local residents and businesses. Further detail on these and other matters is provided in my evidence. I will now briefly discuss the three main areas where I believe the quantified benefit estimates developed by Mr. Paling and Mr. Colgrave are likely to have either over or understated potential benefits to the region. First of all, Mr. Paling appears to have modelled the economic benefits of longer trains up to 20 years early when compared with KiwiRail's statements regarding the likely timing of their introduction. The economic benefits of longer trains account for a high percentage, around 90%, of the overall economic benefits estimated by Mr. Paling. So as results are heavily influenced by his assumptions regarding longer trains. Alternative modelling provided by Mr. Paling in response to a Section 92 information request suggests that correction of the timing issue would reduce the magnitude of his estimated benefits by up to 50% in present value terms. Secondly, the methodology used by Mr. Colgrave to estimate the economic impacts of the construction phase does not take into account the opportunity cost of the resources used in the construction process or the potential for the freight hub to displace other economic activity during what is expected to be a very busy period for the construction sector. This is likely to have had the effect of overstating the GDP impacts of the construction phase. Neither expert has attempted to quantify the long-term investment benefits associated with businesses that start up, expand or relocate to the region as a result of the ongoing operations of the freight hub. I believe these benefits are likely to be significant, and their exclusion will have resulted in quantified benefits being understated. Without conducting an independent analysis, which is outside the scope of my evidence, I've not been able to determine the net effect of these issues on the level of expected benefits. Notwithstanding the above issues, I still believe the project will deliver overall positive economic outcomes for the region. In terms of the quantum of expected benefits, I'd like to make three points of clarification. One is that the $1.3 billion in economic benefits that Mr. Paling expects to flow from the operation of the freight hub is the undiscounted value to New Zealand of the expected benefits over a 60-year timeframe. In my view, a more relevant figure from a cost-benefit point of view is the present value of expected benefits, which Mr. Paling estimates to be around $420 million over 60 years. It is important to note that these figures include the benefits of longer trains from 2030, which is up to 20 years early compared with KiwiRail's statements regarding the likely timing of their introduction. The second clarification is that only a portion of the economic benefits quantified by Mr. Paling are expected to accrue to the Palmerston North area. In paragraph 7.12 of his evidence, Mr. Paling notes that around 20% of the estimated benefits would accrue to rail users in Palmerston North. Mr. Paling's Section 92 analysis indicates that a further 40% would accrue to rail users elsewhere in New Zealand, and the remaining 40% would be spread across New Zealand in the form of reduced environmental, crash and congestion benefits. Third clarification relates to Mr. Colgrave's assessment of the regional GDP impacts of the construction phase, which he estimates at around $490 million over 10 years. I would expect these to reduce to around $150 to $200 million if opportunity costs were considered. I would expect them to reduce further if the construction of the freight hub redirected resources within the region, which I consider to be likely. And they would reduce further still if they were discounted to reflect their net present value. I'll now outline the other issues that I consider to be critical to the long-term success of the project in terms of regional economic development. Section 42A traffic and transportation expert Harriet Fraser has outlined in her evidence a concern that increased traffic volumes connected with the freight hub will cause or exacerbate congestion in several locations within the city's roading network. From my perspective, this has the potential to result in negative economic and social impacts on affected users. These include increased travel times, higher vehicle operating costs, and reduced connectivity between residents and things they value, such as healthcare, employment, education, and friends and family. It could also impose additional costs on the wider community if upgrades to the roading network are required or brought forward because of the activities of the freight hub. The nature and extent of unintended consequences such as these will make a meaningful difference to the actual and perceived success of the project. I accept that the funding and timing of potential road network upgrades caused by the freight hub cannot be fully addressed in this process. However, I support appropriate conditions being imposed relating to the safe and efficient operation of the traffic network and the identification and upgrade of affected parts of the network that will require attention. I defer to the expertise of Ms. Fraser and Ms. Copplestone to ensure that these matters are addressed through conditions. As the panel has heard from CEDA, the freight hub forms part of a broader regional strategy to develop a highly efficient, multimodal freight and distribution precinct in the Northeast Industrial Zone area. The planned precinct, known as the Central New Zealand Distribution Hub, encompasses the NIEZ, Palmerston North Airport, and the proposed freight hub, with connections to the future regional freight ring road. To achieve the desired level of efficiency, it is critical that the freight hub integrates with the other elements of the distribution hub in a way that enables freight to move seamlessly between them. CEDA has outlined the importance of seamless connectivity between the freight hub and NEIZ in the future. I would expect connectivity requirements to change over time as freight movements between the freight hub and NEIZ increase. For example, traffic signalling and or a roundabout may be sufficient in the short term while freight movements are relatively small, whereas grade separation may be more appropriate in the longer term once the NEIZ and freight hub have further developed and freight movements have increased. Given the long-lived nature of the freight hub, it is important that the designation preserves connectivity options for the future, allowing for the possibility that freight movements between the freight hub and NEIZ and or competing traffic volumes on Roberts Line will be higher than expected. In my view, more work needs to be done to understand what the realistic long-term connectivity options are and what needs to be done in the short term to protect them. For these reasons, I support recommendations by Ms. Cobblestone and others requiring KiwiRail to actively engage with NEIZ stakeholders regarding upgrades to the Roberts Line, Richardson's Line intersection, and the solutions required to ensure freight is able to move safely and efficiently between the NEIZ and the freight hub. Given the significant demand that the freight hub will place on the region's roading network, I believe it is critical that the freight hub aligns with and complements Waka Kotahi's planned regional freight ring road program. Ideally, the ring road would be in place by the time the freight hub becomes operational, but at the very least, I believe that the design of the freight hub should support an optimal alignment with the ring road and that roading connections between the freight hub and ring road are made as efficient as possible. Fulfillment of these requirements would enable the efficient transfer of freight between road and rail, maximising the economic benefits of both pieces of infrastructure and advancing the region's objective of becoming a major distribution centre. It would also encourage maximum uptake of the ring road and diversion of trucks away from the central city, which are critical to PNCC's placemaking objectives. I support conditions, including measures within the road network integration plan, that are designed to ensure that efficient and integrated connections with the ring road will be achieved and will not be precluded by the Kiwi Rail design. In my opinion, the level of investment benefits generated by the freight hub will depend, in part, on the degree of certainty that exists in the public domain regarding the delivery and timing of the project. Given the economic benefits expected to accrue to users of the freight hub, rail-dependent businesses will be more likely to invest in the region if they are confident the project will go ahead. Likewise, evidence of investment intentions by rail-dependent firms would be expected to activate investment by businesses wishing to support these firms. A reasonably short lapse period under the RMA would give potential investors the certainty they require to make these long-term investment decisions. Conversely, a longer than necessary lapse period may delay or deter private investment, as well as public investment with a dependency on the freight hub such as the Ring Road. It would also prolong the uncertainty facing owners of affected residential properties and potentially impede their ability to make long-term investments in their properties or divest and move on. Given the large number of businesses, public sector organisations and households whose future plans depend on the outcome of this project, I recommend that the lapse period be kept as short as is reasonably possible. Accordingly, I support Ms. Copplestone's recommendation of 10 years, which I understand is broadly in accordance with the timetable set by KiwiRail for giving effect to the NOR. My overall conclusion is that the proposed freight hub is expected to be positive for the region from an economic perspective. However, I recommend that careful consideration be given to the issues I have outlined to ensure the full economic potential of the project is realised and unintended adverse impacts are minimised. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Vuletic. Because I think have the most interest in economics of all the commissioners, I'll start the questions. The first is, in relation to the lapse period, isn't the converse from an economics point of view that the greater the certainty about the framework, the planning framework within which the build-out would operate, provides greater certainty for investment by KiwiRail in the project itself? In other words, the certainty equation also applies to KiwiRail and its ability to plan and make investments within a planning framework that's certain is partly secures the achievement of the project.
Yeah, so are you saying that KiwiRail's certainty around its designation gives it... Sorry, I'm not quite sure I understand.
If the designation, if it goes to funders and says, we have a designation and its life is 15 years, this is the way in which we can implement the project, this is how we anticipate rolling it out, and we can be certain that this will be the platform, the planning platform that we operate within for 15 years, doesn't that help implementation of the project? So the risk is that if you shorten the time frame and the actual build-out is a longer time frame, that you get a mismatch that affects the funding security.
Yeah, well, I think there's an interesting tension there in that, yes, for KiwiRail, I think they would value a longer lapse period because it preserves optionality for them to do things in certain timeframes and allows things to resolve themselves that are possibly a bit uncertain at the moment. So I absolutely agree that from KiwiRail's perspective, a longer lapse period would give them more certainty and probably provide more certainty that the project would be delivered. However, from the city's perspective, the prolonging of that uncertainty delays a whole lot of potentially important investment decisions. So I guess where we sat on this project was, in a sense, representing the city's interests in relation to the development and trying to take the perspective that the KiwiRail operation, while it may kind of operate from KiwiRail's perspective as a bit of an island within the broader environment, from the city's perspective, it's really important that there's a harmonious relationship between the KiwiRail development and the broader economic system and social system. So yes, from KiwiRail's perspective, they would want it longer, and I think from the city's perspective, they would want it as short as possible so that they can have certainty of what they do next. Otherwise, they find themselves in a little bit of limbo for the next few years and doing nothing. Uncertainty is the best way to end up doing nothing for a period of time.
Maybe addressing those interests, balancing them might look like a more sophisticated lapse condition than just simply saying the consent will lapse after 15 years and putting some refinement around it.
Yeah, I mean, quite often there are, I mean, I've been involved in the relocation of the port in Auckland, and that was a really sophisticated one where we were talking about triggers in that case and saying, you know, what are the triggers? You create some options, but when you trigger those options depends on a variety of things that aren't yet well resolved or well known. I think that's really good practice to, you know, we don't know a whole lot of things at the moment. So what I wouldn't want to see is a really blunt instrument that just says you've got 15 years. I probably also wouldn't want to see a blunt instrument that just says you've got 10 years, but something that's a bit more nuanced that says there are triggers along the way, and as we gather information and more certainty along the way, we'll be in a better position to make a decision on these things.
Yeah, so that's what I'm kind of interested in. So I'd be interested to know through Mr. Jessen what those types of conditions look like, because we're balancing effectively a trinity of interests: the landowner's interests of knowing whether their land is going to be taken or not, the city's interests in the broadway that you've described, and the long-term interests of KiwiRail to have certainty. And
indeed,
I suspect we are trying to argue using a tool where, rather than argue about the time, we should be refining the tool.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
I think that's an absolutely fair point. And it acknowledges the fact that there are a variety of different stakeholders with different incentives and interest in this, and that we need to, there needs to be a compromise or not a compromise, in fact, but just a system that allows us to manage those uncertainties along the way.
So from an economic point of view, the most efficient tools that recognise the different interests would be the most economically desirable.
Yeah, absolutely.
Turning to your paragraph 7C.
In my statement?
Yeah, the summary statement.
Yep.
My impression was that the long-term investment benefits were either not considered by KiwiRail or understated, which may be because the wider benefits were not really the major driver for their project, for this project, for them. So it's not a criticism. But there are two questions, because it seemed to me that just as a layperson, when you create an internal, when you create a port, in this case a internal port, that there are actually agglomeration benefits of quite significant magnitude that follow from them, in the same way that you would for any other economic activity, in that those things that interrelate or depend on it tend to co-locate. And the first thing is, when you're doing an economic analysis, it seems to me that you could do two things. You could potentially model what those benefits might be using a model, but or else you could just rely on historical narrative analysis, which says if you do these things, based on historical experience, you will see these types of benefits. So it's not, it's more of a qualitative than a quantitative economic assessment.
Yeah.
So as a qualitative assessment, do you agree that there is likely to be significant agglomeration benefits associated with distributional, creating a distributional locus of this type?
Yes, absolutely. And that's certainly the vision that Palmerston North has with that broader Central New Zealand distribution hub, and that relies on agglomeration and assumes that if you develop a competitive advantage, if you become really good at something, then people want to gravitate towards that thing and become part of it because it's more efficient and more cost effective. And I think there's already an element of that in Palmerston North. They already have somewhat of a competitive advantage in this space, but the broader plan that Palmerston North has to become that freight hub would take it to the next level and probably give it, higher status than any other place in New Zealand in terms of that role. So I absolutely agree. And I guess where I'm coming from with my evaluation of this, particularly from the city's perspective, is that you can get caught up in those shorter term, construction benefits, for example, which I generally describe as a bit of a sugar hit. They come and they go, but you don't support these projects from a city's perspective because you're going to get a short-term sugar hit out of a construction project. What you're really buying into or investing in the long term is the permanent fixture that is left at the end. And that KiwiRail hub and its broader role within that distribution model that Palmerston North aspires to is what will be the long-term driver of value and competitive advantage for the region. So, yes, it's absolutely grounded in the idea that this will create agglomeration benefits because it will be so much more efficient and so attractive to industry that you would be foolish not to be there.
And my second question falling out of that is, are there models that attempt to quantify those, or are we best to just simply rely on the qualitative ideas?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, and it goes to the heart, actually, of cost-benefit analysis, which is ultimately what we're trying to do here, is weigh up the cost and benefits of a large project and decide whether it's going to be a good thing for the region. And generally speaking, the best practice for approaching those sorts of complex issues is, first of all, to describe it in a qualitative sense, build a narrative around it that is economically sensible and plausible and logical, and then try and give value to it as a secondary step. So if you fail in your quantification, you've still got a very compelling narrative for why you would want to do it, and presumably you can point to some exemplars elsewhere in New Zealand or overseas where this has happened and say, look what happened. We put that in. 20 years later, it looks like this. So I think that narrative's important, but I think once you, in our experience, we do this quite a lot, take things that are quite difficult at the outset to quantify, and once you build that narrative, it starts to shape your thinking and focus your thinking in such a way that quantification becomes easier. And this is often a problem that I see in my particular industry of economics, is people start with quantification and it constrains the outcome to what can be quantified rather than starting with a narrative which can be completely accurate. So I would say absolutely narrative first, but I think there are things that can be done in terms of quantification. I have seen agglomeration modelling elsewhere, which while it's blunt and crystal ball-y, is broadly based on experience elsewhere.
That's an interesting answer to my question. And I guess the follow-on question from that is, in terms of the overall narrative, some of which has actually been led by the City Council in terms of the situational and logistical advantages of Palmerston North, do you find that a compelling story as an economist in the broad sense?
Yeah, absolutely I do. And I think I work all over the country, and I've found working in Palmerston North to be quite refreshing in the sense that they take a really joined up approach to things. And I think probably Palmy has the benefit of being small enough that it's sort of manageable and understandable, but large enough that it's significant. And so watching David Murphy this morning, and I've worked with David a lot in the past, the way that they think about their economy and their broader system as a single integrated system rather than a whole bunch of siloed parts is really refreshing. I think they have a competitive advantage in distribution already. I think that they have all the ingredients of establishing something really quite special there in terms of a multimodal hub that is not replicated elsewhere in New Zealand. And they've got a lot of the planning frameworks, certainly at a council level, in place to deliver that, which is unusual.
Thank you. And then one final question that follows out of that line of questions. It seems to me that, as an interested observer of the world, that distribution is a critical component of designing modern economy. And I know it's, if you go back to Adam Smith, the ability to create efficiencies is critical to, and specialisation is critical to economic development. But at the extreme scale, a lot of the really substantially successful enterprises in the last 20 to 30 years have had as their fundamental characteristic distributional efficiency. I'll take extreme examples, Amazon, Apple, these companies, and I know that's an extreme example, but isn't it true also of regional economies that if they can create the circumstances for those efficiencies, they are crucial to economic success?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the word we often use in this space, and certainly with the port relocation in Auckland, which is really significant, is the removal of friction from the movement of goods, and also the separation of the movement of goods from the separation of the movement of people. Those are two really important design principles that we adhere to when we're talking about freight logistics. Certainly, freight doesn't want to be mixing with people, particularly on roads. It doesn't end well for anyone, in safety terms or in terms of getting to and from places quickly and comfortably. But that removal of friction, which is to reduce cost and allow things to move as efficiently as they can, it oils the wheels of commerce. It reduces cost from the system. It provides certainty. You know your goods are going to turn up on time. And we can see the impact of that at the moment. I mean, we're in a massive global experiment of what happens when you disrupt supply chains, and you can see the knock-on effects of that in our construction industry and elsewhere. So it's an extreme example, but it demonstrates the dependency we have on moving goods to and from places very quickly and seamlessly. And these types of hubs, the new model of distribution is essentially to establish an inland port network, and this could be viewed as some form of inland port connected by rail that is ultimately connected to your sea gateways. So the ship comes in, but it immediately deposits its freight and cargo onto trains, which immediately take the freight to an inland port network that is usually quite close to where the freight wants to start or finish. And then you micro-distribute from there to minimise the amount of time you have trucks on the road and so forth. So, yes, so to me, I mean, this is a big part of the future and part of where we need to go in order to get freight off our congested arterials in and around our cities and onto a rail network that is dedicated to moving freight and it's not getting in the way of people.
Yes, thank you. I very much enjoyed your evidence, and as an economist, you're refreshingly able to integrate the benefits of planning to economic development. So I appreciated that. Thank you. Commissioner Mackinson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Viltich. I also found your evidence to the point and nice and clear. I do have one question, and this is around your section 16 from your summary statement, where you are talking about the difference between actual and perceived success of the project, sort of living and dying on the nature and extent of unintended consequences. And I was wondering if you could expand on that a little more, particularly around what you mean by the perceived benefits. You know, is that the perceived benefits as calculated economically by yourself, Mr. Paley, Mr. Colgrave, or are you talking about how the public views it? You know, what is it that you actually intended to share there?
Sure, no, it's a really good question. And I guess what people don't realise, most people don't realise with economics, is that it's not actually the study of money, it's the study of welfare and well-being in its broader sense. And so in that sense, my remit is very much an umbrella of what everyone's covering off in their evidence, and my overall view on whether I think, you know, the overall benefits of the project outweigh the overall costs, whether they be financial in nature or non-financial in nature. And there's also, I guess, in any form of economics, a social contract of sorts, in that when a large business or even a small business operates in a community, there is a how that business is perceived is actually quite important to the to society. Not only the workings of the economy per se, but the workings of the broader community. And once again, the example I can use in Auckland is of the Port of Auckland, where its social license expired 4 or 5 years ago. And even though it continues to generate a small profit, people don't feel good about that. And that actually infects the community in some way, and it's not a good outcome. And that does have economic consequences and has social consequences. And as an economist, I'm mindful of not only financial outcomes, but also social outcomes, social amenity and social well-being. So I guess those statements are really designed to say we want to design this thing for success, not only financially, but also socially. And what we would like is that sufficient long-term thinking and master planning is put into this development, because it is significant in the wider context of Palmerston North. It's a very significant footprint compared to Palmy. We want to ensure that what we lay down there is going to serve the community well and positively for the next 50 to 100 years. Not only the next 10 in terms of construction sugar hit, but this thing is going to be there for 50 to 100, and it needs to be a good neighbour and a good contributor to society for that entire period, so that we don't wake up in 30 years and really regret putting it there or not having the foresight to impose sufficient conditions on it to be a good contributor to the community for a long period of time rather than a short period of time.
Thank you. That's given me a much better understanding of your intention there. And that was the only question I had. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Commissioner Sweetman.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Vuletich. I found your evidence incredibly clear as well, and well considered. Only one question from me is that, have you had the opportunity to sit down with Ms. Copplestone and go through the council's set of recommended conditions in terms of picking up the issues that you raised?
Yes, we have. So we've had a few discussions around it, not all of them, because not all of them are relevant to us, but certainly some. And actually, we paid particularly close attention to some of the traffic effects, just knowing how traffic congestion can impact economic efficiency in terms of getting goods from point A to point B, but also social efficiency. And the last thing we would want to see is the freight hub put in place, a roading network laid down that serves the community well for 10 or 15 years but breaks down thereafter. And so that was one of our key focuses, was to ensure that we don't make the mistakes of the past where we build infrastructure and we look forward 10 or 15 years but don't preserve options or don't expect the unexpected. Because what I've generally seen in cases like this is the unintended consequences of success, which no one anticipates. When something's really successful, it gets oversubscribed and demand exceeds what you expected it to. And quite often the infrastructure you laid down gets overwhelmed by that success. And if you don't plan for the best, in a sense, that we're wildly successful and everyone wants to locate here and that creates lots of traffic and so forth. If you don't plan for that, you wake up one day and once again, you have regret that you didn't provision for a bit more corridor or so forth. So we have been involved in that, and we've really been trying to push that longer term view to say, let's make sure that we provision for a best case outcome where this is even more successful than we expect it to be. And what does that look like? And let's make sure we at least have a planning scenario that factors in wild success, far more people than we expect in and around that area. And let's make sure that we have a plan B for our transport corridors and so forth that could accommodate that unexpected outcome, unexpectedly good outcome. I think not doing that is not good master planning.
And I think you'd agree, we've seen a lot of around New Zealand examples of not very good master planning.
So many. And the cost of the long-term cost of that, because everyone's looking at their, before they lay down a project, they're looking to rip all the cost out of it and try and minimise their cost on day one. But the cost on day, 10,000, when you have to retrofit a new highway into an area that wasn't designed for that, the CRL in Auckland now is costing us, costing the country $6 billion to put in a rail line that if we'd had the vision 30 years ago to do, would have cost some small fraction. So many examples of that around New Zealand. I don't really want my name associated with a project that, didn't have that degree of foresight and didn't learn from those mistakes that we see every day.
So I suppose that does lead me on to another question, which is similar to what I asked Mr. Murphy this morning. In terms of the whole chicken and egg scenario that many of the submitters have raised, and the issue of predetermination, which many of the submitters have raised as well. So a lot of the submitters have said, well, should this project just be put on ice until such time as there is more certainty in terms of the freight ring, the ring road and other improvements as well. So economically, what's your advice in that regard?
Gosh, that's a tricky one.
It's a tricky one.
It's sort of who's going to, it's a game of, it's not quite a game of chicken, but, the ring road and the freight hub, I think, are two really interesting dynamics, because one's, I guess the Kiwi Rail isn't necessarily waiting for that to go, but if it was there, it would make their planning a lot easier in terms of the road connections. And in some sense, the ring road's sort of sitting there going, oh, well, if and when Kiwi Rail comes along, that might bring us forward. And it's a case of sort of who moves first. And I think there's a political dimension to that, which is a bit tricky. I've been involved in that discussion for a while. But I think there's, one way or another, someone has to move first. I think when there are too many uncertainties, that the uncertainties compound. When you start locking one thing down, suddenly you get a bit more certainty in the next thing and the dominoes start to fall. So it's obviously outside of Kiwi Rail's control to have the, Waka Kotahi commit to its ring road. We would dearly love to see that, because not only would that deliver great benefits, I think, for the ring road and for the community at large, because it gives people, gives freight a place to be on the road. It starts to achieve all of David's visions around placemaking in the CBD. It gets heavy traffic not going through the CBD, which allows you to have walking and cycling initiatives. And there's a whole range of effects that we've looked into around the ring road itself. So we would dearly love to see the ring road go first and be the lead on that, to take a little bit of uncertainty away from Kiwi Rail. But our ability to influence that is quite limited.
Mm. That's really helpful. Thank you very much. And you've given us a lot to think about. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. Commissioner Pamari.
Tēnā koe, Mr. Willitich. Thank you very much for your Section 42A report and for your summary statement that you've provided for us today. You've certainly given us a lot to think about, and you've reignited, I think, a latent interest in economics that must have been on the back burner for quite some time. Contrary to popular belief, though, I am very interested in economics, but perhaps not quite to the same extent as Commissioner Martin. Nevertheless, I did have some questions for you that have been more than thoroughly traversed by the other commissioners. So I have nothing further for you this afternoon other than to thank you again for your very helpful and considered contribution. Kia ora.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is it possible to have a transcript of the oral answer to those questions obtained, because I think it's those answers were very helpful, Mr. Vuletic. And so thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Now, Commissioners, we have one other witness who's been diligently sitting here for most of the session. It's 1:07. I don't think he's going to be very long. And the alternative is we break for lunch and come back, which I think is inelegant. Can we just get through and carry on?